Hello, and welcome to The Found Symbol. We are three actual Freemasons, and we are here to discuss all the symbols, signs, and Easter eggs found in episode 10, final episode, Resonance, of Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol. Catchy music. All right, I'm John, and I'm here with Joe and RJ, and we're gonna talk about it. We made it through all 10 episodes of the miniseries, The Lost Symbol. Fair warning, there will be spoilers ahead if you did not see last night's episode, but we're done with it. Time goes by so fast. What do you think?
I know. I liked it. I liked that it deviated from the book. So there were some surprises. The ending, I think I liked the ending. Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely different than the book.
Yes.
So yeah, I'll give it, four skulls out of five, I think.
Yeah. How about you, Robert? What's the skull rating?
Yeah, skull rating, I'm going to give it four skulls out of five also. I just can't give anything a perfect because, there were some parts, I think, in the ending that could have done something really cool. But maybe backing off and holding out was the way to go, just because they really have left it open for a continuing show. So I'd be interested to see what they do.
Oh, I'm all about the next series of shows, right? Because they did leave on a good cliffhanger, which we'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit. But don't need anyone calling me now.
Let's all listen to John's phone call.
No, I would not like to extend my car warranty. Let's get right to it. The big thing today, no Triskelions. I mean, if you don't have Triskelions, you don't bring Jason Richards on. So, like,
that's right.
There's just no reason to talk about it.
So happy it bumped the skull rating up from 3 to 4 because there were no swirlies.
But what did they do? 9 out of 10 episodes had a Triskelion, just about. So I don't know.
It was good to not have it. I think to move it out of the limelight and to. Like, they introduced this concept of it being a Celtic symbol, and then you begin to see more and more of the Celtic symbol and less of the Triskelion. So, like, in this most recent episode...
Well, let's talk about it, yeah.
Because... You got it, right?
Here we are. We've actually got the Celtic version. So...
Yeah, that's right, ooh. Yeah.
So maybe they did. Gosh, Joe...
Sorry, we're not good at 12 o'clock Eastern, if you haven't noticed. We're kind of bad. We're bad.
It was pretty rad. It was a pretty rad sequence of events when, right, Malak gets his guy to set up these three devices and triangulate them and create the sound of creation, which is interesting as a concept, but when this went off, all I could think about was John, actually, because, like, he's all about the flower of life.
And yeah, that's what I totally thought that was the, the seed of life, the flower of life pattern coming out of that.
But no. Yeah, and so what was really interesting about this sequence was I was kind of unclear, right? They kept talking about how nothing would happen. Nothing's happening. But, like... Did they just illuminate the pattern for us, the audience, or did the character see it? Because that's pretty magical.
Yeah, there's something huge going on.
Right? Yeah, well, they had to, because what's his face? Peter, he was like, ooh, that's a triquetra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he had to have seen it. So, but the idea of the resonance is really interesting. Like, we've talked about cymatics in the past. The idea that this has real effects on things, right? Like, you could vibrate anything at a frequency and destroy it, right? Like, you know, in mythology, you had Jericho's wall. Moses has people that, you know, the people of that, you know, are around Moses say, hey, Moses, you talk to God, because if we talk to him, like, the sound of his voice will kill us.
Right.
All these things. There's this kind of weird idea of sound having real effects on reality. And so we've got the idea of destruction of sound, but we could also have, you know, Newton's law of opposites. So what if sound could create? And my modern science, in terms of what happens in this particular episode, not only with the water, but, like, right, Malak uses this healing vibration on his sister's arm.
Mm-hmm.
And modern science really calls BS on this idea. But it's weird why they call it BS. It's more like it's BS right now. Like, if you kind of read through it, there's just no evidence to suggest it actually works. They have no known success that is attributed to anything other than placebo effect or even psychological conditions of the receiver of such, you know, vibrational frequencies. But that doesn't answer the question about, you know, the millions of people out there today that believe in Reiki or, you know, have followed some of the, I guess we would call it, like, I'll say pseudoscience, but I don't mean it disrespectfully. The pseudoscience on pyramids being like echo chambers or reverberation chambers for healing sick people or whatever.
Crystals with vibrations, right?
Regeneration and things. And so I don't want to discount any of that, but I will say there's this idea of quantum mysticism, and there's a thin line with that, right? Like, I talk a lot about quantum mysticism stuff myself, and I'm always having to be very intellectually honest with a lot of the concepts, right? Like, I don't want to falsely attribute something along the observer issue with, you know, manifesting wealth or something. Like, but there's all these kind of pseudosciences that go along with quantum mysticism. And this is kind of one of those things where he's affecting some real science to make something paranormal happen. Mm-hmm. And I use the term paranormal to mean just, you know, outside the normal
other than normal,
of what,
right,
we would consider. Yeah.
Another thing I found interesting just about the science behind this was the how they had the three different sonic generators kind of like balanced out perfectly. So when they were in the middle, they weren't all getting headaches and everything because they were at kind of that focal point where the vibrations kind of cancel each other out just to make the pretty little picture in the water. So it is provable. And, you know, it's kind of basically the foundation of how your sound reducing headphones work, right? Noise canceling headphones. That's kind of how that works. It takes the input.
It is, yeah.
And then tries to do the opposite of it and cancel out the signal.
It's similar to like wave light theory with what we call interference pattern. So pretty neat.
Yeah. So then let's see, you know, basically not a lot of symbolism this week because it really just kind of closed up the loose ends. In fact, I wish they had closed up a little bit more symbolism loose ends. Well, why do we see this symbol there? But there are a few things. I think just one little hidden Easter egg was in the restaurant where Langdon is trying to figure some things out going forward. The song "I Fall to Pieces" by Patsy Cline is playing in the background, which I think is a nice little cinematic touch, especially where the character is in kind of deciding whether or not to go forward or not. So that's that was a little Easter egg found out by one of our patrons. But then, you know, we start to see more references to this triquetra. So Joe, why don't you talk a little bit about how this triquetra fits in and what it is? All that cool stuff.
Right. So, long story short, it's all aliens. I'm just kidding.
Of course.
Yes. So once the magic resonance guns make that magic symbol inside this underground portal that's under the Washington Monument, which is not really there, folks. There is no secret underground river or lake or whatever under there. It forms the symbol of the triquetra, which Peter says is one of the oldest symbols. Now, he is right. It does talk about a trinity of sorts, but it's definitely not, when it comes to age of symbolism and things like that, it's definitely not the oldest. Now, there's a couple of opinions about the triquetra itself. The first one is it is, well, it basically means triquetra, which is a three-cornered symbol. And some folks say it is three Vesica Pisces put together. And I know John's ears perked up right there. But most oftentimes it's found in Celtic symbology. That's where it stems from and things like that. But most people who study ancient symbolisms date it to around the birth of the Common Era. There's a couple of instances of it showing up a little bit before. Before Common Era times, but it's most prevalent after the Common Era, usually around the second or third century, and especially in the Isles of the UK. So I don't know how ancient it really is. Very cool symbol. You'll see it on a lot of, as I drive down the road, I pass two Catholic churches. They both have triquetras inside their signs. So it has really become
Irish Catholic.
A symbol. Yeah. Very much so. It has really been overtaken, I think, over time as a symbol of, you know, the triune nature of the Christian God. But yeah, in terms of ancient, it definitely does not show up on cave paintings that go back 10 to 15,000 years. So
it's as old as the spirograph.
You know, there might be some
just kidding.
But yeah. Yeah. So as soon as you learn how to draw circles, you're going to draw circles intersecting. So yeah, there could be some facts to that too.
I thought the Vesica Pisces bit was gonna get you all.
Hey,
zesty.
It is pretty cool, right? That's a longer conversation. Go head over to the Masonic Roundtable on Sacred Geometry, and you'll learn lots about that. Let's see. Then we have this super awesome harmonizing water set where Moloch is now preparing the place to be sacrificed.
Yeah, that's right. Like we go through the whole show thinking, right? Like they're setting it up that Moloch, Zach is going to sacrifice Peter Solomon, but he has this smile. He goes, "I'm the sacrifice, bro."
Dun dun right? dun.
I mean, you knew that was coming. I think most people kind of sensed that. But what was cool about this actually is they injected a piece of mythology that actually doesn't have a whole lot around it. I mean, there's a mythology about the dagger basically being used by Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, right? This is the Akedah or Akedah, however you want to pronounce it. I'm not sure, but basically, this refers to the binding of Isaac, right? Isaac, who is going to be sacrificed by his dad, Abraham, to appease God, which was interesting because at the end of the episode, right, Robert Langdon says, why does Abraham need proof of God's existence if he's already talking to God? Like, this was an interesting kind of question, right? And so that same story is told also in the Quran. I think instead of Isaac, it's Ishmael. And Ishmael isn't bound at all. He's actually just, he's like ready to do it. He was given to Abraham by God as a child who would be willing to do this. So what was kind of interesting, though, it's real and not real. It also, if you try to do research on this, you know, you're going to come across the video game, which is interesting in and of itself. Lots of kids play it. But anyway, it's got a lot of the same mythology, the knife and all of this stuff. But that particular knife that you see, the second he pulled it out in a previous episode, I saw it and I was like, oh, that looks almost exactly like King Tut's knife. And I think that's where the writers went with this. So this knife is supposed to have come from a actual meteorite. And they did find the knife that you see on screen in the little white box. That was the one that was actually with King Tut in his tomb, discovered back in the 20s. And some more recent discoveries, right, about the items within that tomb is that they did find some writing about this knife, and it comes to us and says basically that the Egyptians did know that the metal they used to construct the knife came from the heavens. The inscription translates as iron of the sky. And so it is made of meteoric material. And I think the writers pulled from this lore and created this kind of cool story. And they, what's neat about it is they had the freedom to create their own mythology with it. It's not like something like one of the Grail Hollows, right? Like the Spear of Longinus or something. This is almost completely untouched. So it was pretty cool to see where they went with it. Does such a blade still exist today? Well, we absolutely, right. The King Tut blade exists. Is that the same blade? We don't know. But maybe it'll end up in, you know, the Indiana Jones warehouse somewhere. But
protected by top men.
Yeah, that's right. Men. Top men. I was just going to say that I just really enjoyed that they brought something out like that. There is one reference I did find that an angel's tears were able to dissolve the blade after which. And then just as an aside, when Isaac is about to be sacrificed, an angel appears and stops Abraham from doing it. And we see that same scene here in the show. Robert like breaks in and throws a Bible at him, right? Like is Robert at that point the angel,
right?
Zadkiel or Zadokiel? I'm not sure.
He's my angel.
He's your angel.
He's dreamy.
Yeah. So yeah, swooning in.
Yeah,
pretty interesting.
Yeah, there are some interesting parallels. I mean, we alluded to it in one of the Found Symbol episodes about just kind of the generic biblical archetypes, right? Hero's journey. Type of storytelling, and so there are some parallels there as well. So I definitely think there's certainly symbolism, at least correspondence across those as well.
Yep.
Well, just a last thing we'll say on this piece. So there's really nothing you can find that's called an Akedah dagger or an Akedah knife, but Akedah does mean binding in Hebrew. So it references the story, as Robert said, of Isaac and Abraham. So that is called itself the Akedah. But yeah, just spot on with the King Tut knife reference, which I think you can go see. It's in Britain, right? Because all the cool Egyptian artifacts are in Britain and not in Egypt, because they stole everything. So acquired. Yeah. So if you want to see cool stuff, about it, don't go to Egypt. Go to London.
There you go. All right. So then we also have that cornerstone with the triquetra on there, where he easily breaks through this cornerstone, which, I mean, you know, these things are supposed to be rock solid, and he kind of chips away at it with like a pen knife, and he gets his way into the hidden
with a Leatherman
mysteries within.
He got it on special from Kennesaw.
Yeah, I want whatever brand Leatherman he's got, because that thing was legit.
Yeah, very legit. Yes, so not too much super symbolism on this. This is the underground cornerstone of the Washington Monument. So for the history nerds, the Washington Monument was indeed the cornerstone was laid on July 4th, 1848, and it was finished a few years later. And there is a triquetra there, and that's there. I mean, there really isn't symbolically, there isn't much more. They did open the original cornerstone, I think, in the 2000s, but it was some newspaper clippings and a picture of George Washington, and I think his farewell address to the nation. No King James Bible with magic secret ciphers and stuff
that we know of. That they're telling
that we know
us. Right.
Season two.
Right. And so one thing I liked is that they didn't explicit. I mean, yes, we all knew they were going to the Washington Monument, and yet, you know, they don't explicitly say this is the Washington Monument's cornerstone, but you know, you can get that through the date on it as well, and so it is historically accurate in that sense. Yep. Awesome. And then we get thrown this Bible, you know, things happen, Moloch dies, and you know, the day is saved. And I like how they spent like the last third of the episode for like the epilogue, right? 6 months later, where our protagonist is transformed. He's now not this literal, you know, atheist. He's now starting to explore maybe there's something mystical out there. Where, you know, I got jazzed over just this last scene here, right before Sato walks in. Sato. He's doing some work. Sato. He's doing some work on his own little research after class. And so I immediately had to freeze frame this and really nerd out on this, because he's now trying to find the code that was alluded to by Peter Solomon, that, well, you know, maybe the Bible has some hidden code in there. There's other people throughout history that have been studying it. Why shouldn't we? And here we are, like, fast forwarding, getting ready for maybe a season two where we're actually deconstructing the Bible. So, okay, so now what is he doing here? Well, he's turned to the first page of Genesis, circled certain words. You can see in the upper right, he's talking about Bacon's bilateral cipher, where, you know, it was alluded to by Peter Solomon. Hey, Francis Bacon was studying this code, and sure enough, Francis Bacon does have a cipher, not biblical per se, but Francis Bacon came up with his own little way of encoding messages by like bolding or changing the typeset of certain letters. And if you follow this pattern, you can hide codes like steganography inside of other text. Pretty simple to break nowadays, because you just can just run a query on it and see which fonts are changed. But back in the day, this was like cool stuff, right? May or may not have actually been used. There's some debate about Francis Bacon's bilateral cipher actually being used, because it requires two different two different fonts, if you want to think of it that way. And back in the day, there was no easy way to have a duplicate set of typesets for printing press. And then if you were to like copy a book, how would you make sure you got the same typesets and make sure you carried the code through? So that was interesting. Also, further detail, looking at these words that are circled are italicized. So specifically, these words jump out of the page. And so that's what he's trying to do, is to see, is there some combination of why these letters are italicized differently than the rest of the text? You also see an 888 at the top, which in some numerical circles, right, either means like, you know, new beginnings, which in Christian numerology, 888 is the number of Jesus, primarily because if you use gematria on the Greek word or the Greek letters for Jesus, it totals up to 888. So that's how they get that. So there's interesting there. Why would they put 888 there on the first book of the Bible, when it really references the latter part of the Bible? And then also tried to see if there's anything here about the firmament or the grass, these kind of code words here. Nothing really jumped out, but I do think it's fascinating that, you know, there are lots of different ciphers to study the Bible, you know, throughout the years, right? And Isaac Newton's been trying to decipher the Bible, right? And you heard some of these others, Francis Bacon and the like. There's the Bible Code, which is a really, really popular book that came out a couple of years ago. And again, there's just lots of different ways to try to break this down. And if anyone can crack it, Robert Langdon can. So I'm rooting for it.
And Robert Johnson.
Yeah, right. I love ciphers and things too, but my thought process on this was just like, it could be any number of really cool ciphers and things that had been out there. And you mentioned, right, that there's ways to put this into different programs that have been written. And like, actually, I just pulled while we were talking, or while you were mentioning this, I got this great book on codes, and it had a couple interesting facts, right? And it says that at the time of writing, The state-of-the-art cipher is a computer sequence with 2,048 figures each, which can be a number, letter, or symbol. The combinations are in trillions of trillions,
nice.
And it is estimated that even the fastest computers in the world couldn't break it in less than 30 billion years. Oddly enough, created by a 17-year-old kid in Kent, Peter Parkinson. And actually, also right now in America, it is illegal in America to export an encryption program with more than 40 digits without providing a key, which takes approximately 3 days to break a 56-bit encryption. So it's pretty interesting how that still applies today.
Yep, which is a really good summary of, you know, if you're trying to keep something a secret, then there's always going to be a way to hide that data. And whether it's in the Bible, whether it's in signs and symbols, that really is a good summary of the show. So that's all we found. What did you find? Let us know in the comments below. If you like this kind of content, head on over to the Masonic Roundtable and subscribe, like, follow, smash the little bell thing. And this has been great. This has been a fun journey. Any closing thoughts on the lost symbol writ large, starting with Joe?
I dug it. I love that they deviated from the book. So hopefully we get some new Robert Langdon stories that aren't rehashes of other Dan Brown books, because they've covered those in movies. But I definitely dug it. Piqued my curiosity. And I like how they made up some things and gave us some things to think about. So 4 skulls out of 5, highly recommend it. And if you don't like it, just cancel your Peacock subscription.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Robert.
Yeah, I feel like the show was really amazing. I had a lot of fun watching it. You know, at a time where there's tons and tons of mediocre television out there, I know this show had its ups and downs in relation to people critiquing the acting or whatever else. But I really felt that as the show progressed, we got entrenched. We started to care about the characters. They did good character development. There was ups and downs that we didn't see coming because, of course, they deviated from the book, which is always a plus when they do these kinds of things. You know, you always have the people out there. They go, oh, I can't believe they deviated from the book so much. Well, maybe they need to make two versions, right? One for the bibliophile who just wants to see the same thing they saw in their head when they read the book. And then for the rest of us who want a little something new, right? We want to be a little bit surprised. And they did that for us for sure. And I'm with Joe. I really hope they continue to develop this, even if it starts a whole new canon or a different trajectory of reality for the Robert Langdon series. Yeah, you know, like it'll be it would be cool. I'm totally down with it. I think they could take this for, all the characters they're using are young enough. They could continue making this and, you know, they could pull 9 seasons out if they wanted to, which would be really cool. So that's what I think. And I really appreciate all of you guys tuning in, watching this and talking about all the cool signs and secrets that we found and that you found. And again, yeah, if you like this kind of stuff, check out Masonic Roundtable.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Robert. Just to close, I do think this does set up a universe for Robert Langdon in the future. I look forward to seeing whatever else they come up with because it is better than most TV. So if you like this kind of stuff, head over to the Masonic Roundtable and we'll see you every week. Take care.